voters go to the polls today, 380 cities will choose a mayor in Virginia, and New Jersey will vote for a governor.
I've had choices since the day that I was born. There were voices that told me right from wrong.
And right or wrong, like it or not, as many voters mark their ballots, Barack Obama will be on their minds.
I think sometimes he tries to gain too much of a consensus, if there's a such thing. If you think it's in the best interest of the country, just march forward.
How are Obama's choices in the Oval Office affecting your choice on the ballot today?
Living and dying with the choices I made.
Marking a ballot and making a statement on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 3rd. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Also on the program, Afghanistan says never mind to its election. And the question is, does that make the Obama administration happy? The Phillies are alive. The Saints are awesome, it turns out. Some bankers get scolded over their pay and picking a health care plan. Not on Capitol Hill, in the workplace.
But first, Jonathan Alter joins us. Jonathan is a national affairs columnist at Newsweek. Jonathan, you just heard that cut from a Republican voter who actually voted for President Obama, saying the president hasn't been aggressive enough. But it makes you wonder, are people really voting today based on Obama's performance in their local elections?
I don't think so. I think it's maybe 10% a verdict on Obama, maybe 10% a test of whether Obama's organization from 2008 is still relevant locally, and about 80% on local issues. You got to remember, as Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local.
We've been saying that a lot, Jonathan. Jonathan Alter, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment. First, everything you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, voters across the country are heading to the polls today for Election Day 2009. They're choosing governors in Virginia and New Jersey, mayors in 380 cities, including right here in New York City. In economic news, we've just learned that Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, is buying the railroad firm Burlington Northern in a deal worth $34 billion, which he can easily afford. In Philadelphia, commuters are waking up to a public transit strike. That means all bus, subway, and trolley services are suspended, as well as some suburban transit union workers are striking over a dispute about contracts. Nearly a million trips are taken on Philadelphia public transit every day.
Maybe it's a good thing the next World Series game is in New York then. Overseas, probably. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has invited the Taliban to take part in peace talks. He says he wants an inclusive government. He was declared winner of the Afghan presidential election. And the World Series moving back to the Bronx. As we said, the Phillies beat the Yankees 8-6 last night. The Yankees lead that series 3-2. Wall Street was up just a smidgen yesterday. The Dow starts trade at 97.89. The S&P will kick off at 10.43, and the NASDAQ opens up at 20.49. So we have studies saying that more Americans than ever are now on food stamps. Is that a result of the recession? Either way, we're wondering, what do you think about that? Have you ever been on public assistance, and is there still a stigma attached to getting food stamps or assistance from the government? Let us know.
I bet if there was a public list of everyone who's ever been on food stamps, there'd be some pretty surprising
names
there. Yep, I'd be on that list.
877-8-MY-TAKE. Let me give you the right number, or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. It is Election Day. However, it's a midterm election. That means, except for the gubernatorial races in New Jersey and in Virginia, most of these elections are going to be about school boards and local politicians and city council members and mayors. So the question is it fair to paint this election as a check-in on Obama's achievements? We're asking that question to Jonathan Alter. He's the national affairs columnist at Newsweek, and he's working on a first year of Obama presidency book right now that starts with November 2008. So Jonathan, you're actually spending a lot of time looking back over the first year of President Obama's term in office, and you just said that you don't think that this midterm election is fair to paint this as a check on Obama's achievements, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, it's all we have, so people make do with any kind of little test that they can. And the importance of these elections in Virginia and New Jersey go back to 1993, when in a shocker, a Republican, Christy Todd Whitman, was elected governor of New Jersey shortly after Bill Clinton had been elected president, and it was seen as kind of a harbinger of the wipeout in 1994 when the Republicans took control of Congress. So ever since then, these have taken on outsized importance. But I don't think, if you look at it closely, they really are terribly relevant, and the local issues greatly dominate. Just to give you a very quick example, in New Jersey, where I live, Barack Obama has very high approval ratings in the state of New Jersey, even higher than they were when he was elected.
Interesting.
And yet the governor of New Jersey, John Corzine, is in considerable difficulty, and the race today is too close to call.
I've always been suspicious of coattails anyway. I mean, if people can't tell the difference between their president and their governor, they probably shouldn't be voting.
And they're not voting, because people who vote in these elections tend to be more activist voters. The turnout is much, much lower than it would be in a presidential election.
In the midterm elections. All right. Well, a lot of people are actually getting a lot of mileage going on talk shows and news shows. And here we have Saturday Night Live making fun of what President Obama supposedly has not accomplished.
Almost 1 year and nothing to show for it. You don't believe me? You think I'm making it up? Take a look at this checklist. On my first day in office, I said I'd close Guantanamo Bay. Is it closed yet? No. I said we'd be out of Iraq. Are we? Not the last time I checked. I said I'd make improvements in the war in Afghanistan. Is it better? No, I think it's actually worse.
So, Jonathan Alter, there's three things they listed there as things he has not accomplished: closing Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, pulling troops out of Iraq, and making improvements in the war in Afghanistan. In the first year of the presidency, are these fair criticisms?
No. This skit was very funny, but completely preposterous. He proposed that he would close Guantanamo on January 1st, 2010. So he did not propose that he was going to close it on his first day in office. He's not going to meet that deadline, but that's not an unfulfilled promise yet, because we're not to 2010. You know, as far as Afghanistan goes, he promised during the campaign that he was going to escalate in Afghanistan, and he has. So he kept that promise. As far as Iraq goes, he promised that he was going to wind down the war over a course of 18 months, and he's perfectly on schedule in terms of his troop withdrawals from Iraq. And then that you didn't use the cut in the thing where he says, and he hasn't gotten health care, and the character playing Obama on SNL is very humorous about that. But on that, the facts are that Obama promised that he would do something about health care by the end of his first 4 years in office. So he's 3 years ahead of schedule, because that's about to happen. So, really quite funny skits have a power in our culture that doesn't bear a lot of resemblance to the facts. That's not to say I approve of everything he's done so far, but we should keep our eye
on fair,
the fact,
right?
He's been successful overall.
Well, it sounds to me like there's two issues here. There's checking in on a year of Obama's presidency, and then there's the midterm elections. We've got Patrick Henry Bass to maybe give us some more realism here. He's a Takeaway contributor and senior editor at Essence. And Patrick, I want you to take a listen to this particular voter's comment.
I'm afraid I wasn't realistic. I really thought there would be immediate change. I really did. I thought this is the end of politics. He wants us to all be bipartisan as long as they agree with the Democrats, but that isn't bipartisan.
That's Pauline McGarvey. She's a Republican. She switched parties in Iowa to support Obama. You're nodding your head. Does this sound like a familiar sentiment?
Well, Pauline and I just hung out at a tea party at 4 o'clock. We're just having a good time there. And I too wanted immediate change. That's a joke. We have a package in the November 2009 issue of Essence magazine called We Dream a World, which is looking at the election looking at Barack Obama's presidency from a viewpoint that no one discussed, and that is from African-American men. During the campaign, we heard from the NASCAR dads, we heard from soccer moms, we heard from the Latino vote, Barack Obama is an African-American man, and the bloom is certainly not off the rose with Barack Obama, with African-American voters. But what we were going to call the package was the year of magical thinking, because that's what it was. I mean, we're looking at an unprecedented time in American history, an unprecedented leader, and he's an intensely polarizing figure, but he has a lot of charm, a lot of charisma, and a connectivity to people that we haven't seen, I think, in a past generation.
But, you know, one of the other things we haven't seen is real change in America in the last generation. We've had a lot of symbolic senses of the possibility of change, and that the voter speaks to it there. I guess one of the frustrations is when things actually begin to change, when the rubber hits the road here, it's going to be unfamiliar territory.
Of course, John, and it's only 287 days, but some of the changes that we are seeing, we took a poll at Essence.com, and African-American males overall feel, you know, that the country is pretty bleak. Last year, you and I were talking about Dickens. It was pretty Dickensian.
That's right. That's
in terms
right.
of the narrative for you America. Heard. Now it's kind of Dreiser-esque, yeah. right? but there has been a change in terms of African-American boys. African-American boys are now suggesting that they have a hero who is not an athlete, who is not a rapper, who is not an entertainer, who they are very much striving to be. Like, the fact that Barack Obama is from a single father, and he has, against insurmountable odds, one of the highest goals in the land, is having an impact on African-American boys that we're not going to see in polls.
Where are we going to see it? Where are we going to see it? Where is that? Is it going to be in schools? Is it going to be?
John, it's in schools. Yeah. African-American attendance of boys is up in schools. You know, African-American girls are now doing, not because of Barack Obama, they're leading the way in science. That was something that's been happening over the past decade. We now may see a turnaround in African-American boys in math and science. And Barack Obama will have a hand in that, despite what seems to be a rather lackluster education plan.
So, Jonathan Alter, let's go back to you, National Affairs columnist at Newsweek. You heard what we're talking about, the fact that we're not going to see the so-called Obama change among the polls. But I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people felt like Barack Obama was a complete departure from politics as usual. And is, as we go into these midterm elections, have people lost that sense of hope in politics? When they're going to the polls today, are they a little bit less hopeful and optimistic about their vote?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they've hit what you could call the reality of hope. You know, and there was a year of magical thinking that applied to a lot of voters. But, you know, as Mario Cuomo said, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose.
Yeah.
And so it's really, you know, tough to, as they say, make the sausage on Capitol Hill. And he's done quite a bit of it. The stimulus bill was really about four or five landmark pieces of legislation in one. So this idea that he hasn't been getting things done is not quite right, but it's also not right that he was able to, you know, wave a magic wand and make everybody sing Kumbaya. That did not happen. There was no honeymoon at all from the Republicans, who indicated from the very first day of his presidency that they were not going to cooperate with him. So that whole bipartisan idea went out the window very early, and, you know, it's been replaced by a kind of a hard slog on a variety of different issues. I would disagree on education. You know, I think actually that's been one of his most successful areas, because he's finally getting tough on accountability and standards, mm-hmm. Which is something we've needed in this country for a long time, and he's doing it very effectively, which we could talk about if you wanted. I have a bigger problem with him on the bank bailouts, which were necessary, but kind of offensive and smelly.
I think we're going to be obviously checking in on many of these issues in the months to come. That's Jonathan Alter, National Affairs columnist at Newsweek. We're also joined by Patrick Henry Bass, Takeaway contributor and senior editor at Essence.
Doesn't feel like a whole year, you know?
It doesn't.
Whoosh.
I want Bush back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
So it's time for some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. And we're going to go first to our Supreme Court reporter, Louise Story, from the New York Times. Louise, you report about business, but today you're talking about the Supreme Court. What is the Supreme Court doing talking about mutual funds?
Well, they're talking about compensation. So that's how I get interested, because, you know, we're always talking about how should you pay people on Wall Street right now. It's a very hot issue. But they were looking at mutual funds, which is a very important area because, you know, a lot of us have money in mutual funds. And they were looking at fees that the people who manage mutual funds pay and whether they're too high. There's a 1970 law about this. It says, at some point, can fees be so high that it breaches your fiduciary duty to help people have a good return? Right. And on appeal, the court in Chicago had said, well, leave it up to the marketplace. People can figure it out. But the Supreme Court said, we need to look at this law and figure out if at some point, these are too high. So they're really looking at a sense of fairness and responsibility, which could have broad-ranging effects.
And how did the arguments go? Did we get any sense about which way they're going to weigh in?
Well, no. All we know is that they very clearly said, both sides said, that the argument that you should leave it up to the marketplace is not right here. That we need to look at this law. We need to look at how high is too high. And this is really different from what we're seeing among regulators with the banks. So the other thing that was going on is we were all, you know, all the reporters who I sit with, we were watching this meeting that the Fed was having with banks about compensation. But the reason this Supreme Court situation is very different is the Supreme Court is focused on fairness of fees and how much you should charge people, whereas the Fed is focused only on risk. Is the pay we're paying on Wall Street so high it'll cause risky behavior that they will bring our system again down? Not about fairness. And so we're all sitting around waiting for this meeting to end at the Fed. It was very momentous. They had all the CEOs there, a bunch of people from the boards. And then we get on the phone afterwards. We call people and they say, yeah, it was 7 minutes long. It was very non-eventful.
Slap on the wrist.
It seems like it was very non-eventful. But one of the funny things, too, is a lot of the people who went from the boards of directors of these banks were people who have been criticized for their own pay. So, for instance, J.P. Morgan, they had one of their members of the board go, Lee Raymond, who used to be the CEO of Exxon. And when he retired from Exxon, he got a $400 million retirement package. So this is the kind of person that's helping to advise on comp at J.P. Morgan. Well, I hope he can live on it. Could you live on that?
I don't know.
Okay, Louise Story is our finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Todd Zwillick couldn't live on $400 million in Washington. No takeaways, Washington correspondent. So let's talk about climate change. It was a huge campaign issue a year ago when Barack Obama was running. But the fight is being led on Capitol Hill by Barbara Boxer. And this seems to be a story of Barbara Boxer on climate change versus the rest of the Senate, even including some of her Democratic colleagues. What's going on with climate change and Barbara Boxer?
Well, Barbara Boxer can be one of the most fiercely partisan members of the Senate, John. Good morning, by the way.
Good morning, bud.
You remember how partisan and nasty health care got in the town halls in August. Well, that dynamic has sort of moved to the halls of the Senate right now. Senator Boxer's climate bill, which is, of course, cap and trade, capping carbon emissions by the year 2050, is going into a markup in her environment committee. She's the chairman. It's supposed to be going in today. But Republicans are boycotting this meeting today. They're not showing up. They say that Boxer has not been forthcoming with the details of the bill. They have not had time to analyze truly what the bill would do to the economy, to American industry, not to mention to the environment and to taxpayers. So if they don't show up, that could prevent her, under the rules, it's a little unclear, from having a vote. She would have to circumvent some committee rules to ram this bill through. So now the question is, will Republicans show up at all? Here's Senator Frank Lautenberg. He's a liberal Democrat and a member of the committee.
Their behavior challenges everything that we're about here. If you don't like it, turn your back and walk out. It's almost like school children over there. I'm not quite as gracious as Barbara Boxer might be. I think that we have to tell it like it is.
Okay, that's one frustrated Democrat, but the Republicans sound like they actually might want this to come to the floor, right?
Well, they actually do not want it to come to the floor. They want this confrontation to come to pass. Boxer yesterday shifted gears a little bit. She went from bad cop to Good Cop, she said, well, we'll make the markup go slower. We'll suspend it for hours. We'll let Republicans come and ask as many questions as they want of some EPA people we're bringing in. I'll extend the deadline for their amendments. I'm being patient. I really want them to participate. So now the question is, how long will Barbara Boxer remain the good cop and shift back to bad cop with her friend against her friend, Republican James Inhofe, who's the ranking member, her old nemesis on the Environment Committee? Here's Inhofe.
I hope she tries to do this in some way, whether you call it a nuclear option or whatever you might call it, because I think that's going to be very bad. It's not looked upon favorably by the public, and I think that if she does it, let her go ahead and do it. They don't have the votes anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Well, it sounds like a little opportunism there. The Republicans would love to use this bill as an issue to skewer the Democrats in any case. Todd Zwillick, Capitol Hill correspondent for The Takeaway. Thanks, Todd.
And finally to sports with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And when you're in the World Series, it looks like the championship ring is your main goal.
The bottom line is to win the game, however you need to do it. Whether it's hitting, pitching, defense, it doesn't really matter who steps up. It's just a matter of when and how.
And that's Philadelphia's second baseman, Chase Utley. So, Ibrahim, it looks like the people who stepped up was the Phillies last night.
Yes, and they did. They won 8-6 in Philadelphia. And the question is, you know, Cliff Lee pitched an impressive game. He's doing his best impersonation of Sandy Koufax, like we just said. But the question is, who's a bigger hero for the Phillies than second baseman Chase Utley, who we just heard from?
A 3-run homer in, like, the first inning?
And he put them up for good. He put them up, and then he tacked on a late home run. And these are not just little piddly little home runs that are just going over the wall. These are monster home runs that he's getting all of the bat on. But the thing about him is that he's like this. His hair is slicked back. He never smiles. He's always grimacing. He's like the good-looking Terminator in Terminator 3, where he's just out to kill and out to destroy at every single moment.
And he sounds half asleep when he's talking about getting 5 home runs in the series.
I think as a Yankee fan, the only thing I would want to see is them win something just to see him smile.
Yeah. The good-looking Terminator.
That's right. What would make him smile?
When he just tied Reggie Jackson for a number of 5 home runs in a World Series,
right?
And that was made by Reggie Jackson in 1977.
Yeah.
So I think he's waiting to go back to the Bronx to break that record, and I think that's something to look for. Is Chase Utley? He's been a Yankee killer. He's been abusing the ace. Well, yeah, so then he would be a Jackson killer. So, yeah, so that's amazing. And on the flip side, Ryan Howard, who came in with a record number of RBIs, has 12 strikeouts in the World Series, which ties a strikeout record.
Yeah, he's not having a fun time.
We're going to see the next game on Wednesday with the Philadelphia Phillies coming to New York, and we'll see how that works with the Martinez pitching.
Yeah, with the revenge of Pedro Martinez. We'll see.
Thanks so much. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is a Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, president or puppet there in Afghanistan. Who's happiest about the outcome for Hamid Karzai? We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. It's election day here in the U.S. Governorships in New Jersey and Virginia up for grabs. Also, 380 mayoral elections around the country today. Some see these races as a litmus test of President Obama. And tomorrow marks 1 year since President Obama was elected to the White House. In Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai has promised to tackle corruption. That's after he was declared winner of the election yesterday. He also appealed to the Taliban to take part in peace talks. In Europe, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has appeared at his trial in The Hague. He's facing charges of genocide and war crimes. Karadzic boycotted the trial's start last week, saying he needed more time to prepare his defense.
Back at home, workers from Philadelphia's largest transit union are on strike this morning. That's after negotiations on new contracts broke down. Nearly 1 million public transit trips are made each day in Philadelphia when the workers are not on strike. Holiday travel could cost more again this year. Speaking of traveling, most of the largest U.S. airlines have doubled a surcharge on the busiest travel days to $20. The fee applies to busy periods like Thanksgiving and Christmas. And those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
So, to Afghanistan. President Obama seemed pretty happy with everything that happened over the weekend in Afghanistan.
Although the process was messy, I'm pleased to say that the final outcome was determined in accordance with Afghan law.
messy process. Well, at least 70% of the electorate stayed home in the voting that resulted in the non-runoff election. Hamid Karzai is the president, and he was speaking about what happens now in Afghanistan this morning at his first news conference since being reelected.
As I've said many times before, I don't have an opposition. I don't have any personality or any group as my opposition, and I don't want to be opposed to anybody. That's why I don't have a political party. So my government will be for all Afghans, and all those who want to work with me are most welcome, regardless of whether they opposed me in the election or whether they supported me in the election.
Well, by the most generous count, if you throw out the obviously corrupt votes in the Afghan election, Hamid Karzai received half of 30% of the eligible voters in Afghanistan. That hardly constitutes a mandate. What does it constitute? Tony Karen joins us. He's a senior editor at Time.com. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Tony.
It seems to me that your theory is actually a pretty interesting one, that this outcome was the preferred option of Barack Obama and the Obama administration, that has spent so much time talking about how democratic legitimacy in Afghanistan is the hallmark of its policy there. Do you agree with that, that Obama is thrilled with this outcome?
I don't think he's thrilled with this outcome. I think, frankly, we've been led on a merry dance to see the outcome of the election as the prime measure of legitimacy, which it can't possibly be because, as you noted, so many people stayed away from the polls. I think that this whole exercise has been one in trying to leverage Karzai into behaving more and into governing more along the lines that the U.S. wants him to do, to be more inclusive, to cut out corruption and so on. And so we all knew that this was going to be the outcome, and this exercise has been quite meaningless in terms of Afghan legitimacy.
So does that mean that Karzai has to deliver the Taliban in some sort of legitimate power-sharing form for the Obama administration to give him credibility and for the Afghan people to consider him someone with any sort of power to move forward?
Well, I think that it's a little more complicated than that. I think that is Karzai's instinct is to talk to everybody. I think he's quite genuine there. Remember, he was parachuted in 2002 and had to, you know, make do, and he makes do by making deals with whoever has power on the ground. So I think quite legitimately he wants to talk to the Taliban. And the Obama administration understands that ultimately there's going to be a political solution here that will involve the Taliban. Frankly, they're fighting right now because they believe, you know, until the Taliban doesn't think it can win the war, it's not going to actually sue for peace. So that is what is required of Karzai. But at the moment, they see the corruption of the Karzai regime on the ground is actually delivering the people to the Taliban, or at least the, you know, things on the ground to the Taliban. So it needs him to deliver good governance and also, you know, obviously to negotiate with the Taliban ultimately.
You know, let me give you a really cynical theory here. You know, now that Karzai is the president and President Obama says it was messy, but it was sort of democratic, does this set the stage for a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, that as far as the American people are concerned, Obama can say, hey, we won, it's now up to the Afghans?
Well, that would be... It would be right. Take a bit of a stretch of the imagination, given what, you know, might happen immediately after the U.S. withdrawing. I mean, I think that it's definitely for domestic consumption that, you know, we have this election and so on. But I think it's ready to justify staying there. I don't think Obama is going to want to be the president who is called the man who lost Afghanistan, whether that's legit or not. He doesn't want to go into the next election having sort of seen the Taliban storming into all sorts of territory in Afghanistan. I think, like it or not, he is going to escalate and send more troops to Afghanistan, even if he thinks it's a short-term fix to try and, you know, fight the Taliban to a standstill and then negotiate terms of withdrawal.
And that's a decision that's going to be made in the next couple of weeks, according to administration officials. All right, well, then let's turn it around and focus on a question that you think is central. So how difficult is it going to be for the Obama administration, given the events of the last weekend, to sell the American public on what even constitutes a victory in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that is a really tough question, because I think that in its heart of hearts, or the Obama administration really knows that there's not going to be a decisive victory in Afghanistan at best. You know, even McChrystal says we need 40,000 more troops to stop the Taliban winning, not to have the U.S. win. So I think that they're going to have to muddle through with the message that, you know, focusing more on the negative, i.e. the consequences of what will happen if the U.S. withdraws rather than on the sort of achievement of what will happen if it stays.
Meanwhile, the Taliban has a pretty easy argument to the people of Afghanistan. We won. We shut down the election. The runoff had to be canceled. Most people stayed home. We're basically the winners.
Well, yes. I mean, they're definitely buoyed by this because, you know, as you said, they'll claim the 70% stay away from the polls as a vote for them. Obviously, it isn't. But the Taliban is certainly, you know, feeling the wind at its back and feeling, you know, both militarily and politically that it's doing a lot better than its enemies in Afghanistan.
And is it possible to fight the Taliban to some sort of standoff that would constitute a victory? I mean, is there political maneuvering with the Taliban, in your view?
Well, I think that will certainly come, and that will certainly involve sort of regional actors from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia and people who've had influence traditionally with the Taliban. Fighting it to a standstill is a tougher one. I think that it sounds, by all accounts, that the strategy will be more about defending the cities, which really puts the U.S. in a position eerily similar to that of the Soviets in Afghanistan in the late 80s.
Tony Karen, senior editor at Time.com. His argument on Time.com is that the U.S. wanted the opposition leader Abdullah Abdullah to drop out in the Afghan election and for the runoff election in that country to be canceled. Coming up, we talk about your work life every Tuesday. Today, picking a health plan, not in Congress, but in your employment, place of employment. It's a tough choice, and there are fewer later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It is the largest deal in Berkshire Hathaway history. That's Warren Buffett's company. It's also a bit of an investment and economic indicator of sorts. Berkshire Hathaway has decided to buy the Burlington Northern Railroad, or at least what of it it doesn't already own. It's a deal worth $44 billion, $34 in paying for the railroad and $10 billion in assuming the Burlington Northern's debt. Joining us now is Michael De La Merced, business reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
You know, Warren Buffett has said, quote, it's an all-in wager on the economic future of the United States. Now, is this the kind of thing where Berkshire Hathaway is going to put enormous amounts of investment into the railroad to make it more modern and bigger and more competitive? Or is Warren Buffett just positioning himself to get a kind of trickle down of money as business activity improves and there's more demand for the services of Burlington Northern?
Historically, Warren Buffett doesn't really meddle in the operations of the company he buys. He basically identifies management that he likes and the overall direction of the company. And in this case, it still seems like he's going to let the railroad be. He's going to support it however he can financially. But he's basically going to let them go. It really, if anything, this just signals his bet that railroads will improve and that the country's economy is going to get healthier.
And let's not forget that Berkshire Hathaway, until this morning, and this deal will close on 2010, had, you know, upwards of $50 billion in cash. They still have $20 billion after they complete this deal or so. I mean, this is a pretty healthy company, but I'm wondering if there are particular sectors of the economy that would be affected by Burlington Northern doing well.
Sure. Well, if anything, the health of the railroads is sort of an indicator of other parts of the economy doing well. They ship goods, so, you know, if businesses are producing and customers are buying, that means a healthy time for the railroad. So it's part of this sort of interweaving of different sectors of the economy. It would position Warren Buffett pretty well if it were if the economy does continue to improve. And as you said, that he's laying down a lot of his own money. He's actually splitting his stock, which is something he doesn't historically do. But he feels pretty strongly that this is the right bet for him to make at this time.
A cynical view would say this is actually a no-brainer. It's all about coal. All he's really doing is betting on the demand for coal improving in an environment where energy is going to be more needed, and that's pretty much what Burlington Northern hauls.
You could certainly make that. You could also certainly take that view. Warren Buffett has, in fact, this morning he was saying that he thought that this was a great way to move things about the country because it's cleaner than trucking. But it's entirely possible that he's also betting on the importance of coal. I couldn't really offer an opinion on that.
Yeah, well, that's okay. We don't want to put you on the spot. Michael De La Merced, business reporter for the New York Times. It's funny, though, this morning the futures trading on Berkshire Hathaway stock is up, and also Burlington Northern stock is up. Usually when there's a merger, the company being merged, the stock goes down. So it's just an indication of what people think about Warren Buffett. Michael De La Merced, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Business reporter for the New York Times reporting on Warren Buffett buying Burlington Northern for $44
billion. I feel like an old railroad man who's really tried the best that he can to make his life add up to something good, but this engine.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. So when premiums are soaring through the roof and your options are getting more and more limited, how do you make a choice on a healthcare plan at work? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has invited the Taliban to take part in peace talks. He says he wants an inclusive government. And in Washington, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is addressing both chambers of Congress today. She's making the case for a global deal on climate change.
In the World Series, the Phillies beat the Yankees 8-6 last night. The Yankees still lead the series 3-2. The teams meet in Game 6 tomorrow night. It's Election Day 2009. 380 cities are electing mayors. Some races are gathering some national attention, like New York and Atlanta. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Susan Capiluto joins us. And Susanna, you know, last year, a year ago tomorrow, the polling places in your neck of the woods and all over the country were just overflowing with enthusiasm for Barack Obama. I gather it's a little different this time around.
Absolutely. We were actually talking about it this morning. When the polls opened, there were maybe a dozen people ready to vote this morning. That was a different story last year. We were talking about how it was snaking all the way around the building. And so turnout for this mayoral race is expected to be very, very low.
And that's not really a surprise, even though the mayoral race could make some history today, right?
It could make history. Atlantans could elect the first white mayor since 1970. Mary Norwood, she's a city councilwoman, and she was polling in the 40s. So depending on who turns out to vote, experts do predict a runoff between her and two of the African-American candidates, former State Senator Kasim Reed or City Council President Lisa Borders.
What's the number to watch that would really determine how that runoff is going to go? Below 30, above 30?
It's very hard to tell. It's almost like who can get their people out to the polls today? Who will be out there, you know, carting people out in the numbers that matter? It is very hard to say whether a high or low turnout would actually help or hurt Mary Norwood.
And, you know, last year it was a lot of first-time voters, a lot of just people with kind of wide-eyed enthusiasm about voting. It's mostly activists for an election like this in Atlanta, right?
I'm sorry, activists?
Activists, yeah,
well,
you know.
You don't see that. It's really not there this time around. The issues are very much down. You know, taxpayers don't want to pay higher property taxes. Crime is one of those issues. City finances and potholes.
Local politics.
So it doesn't really have a broader sense.
All right, thanks. Susanna Capiluto from Georgia Public Broadcasting, reviewing the polling sites there in Atlanta. Thanks.
It's Tuesday. That means it's time to talk about work on The Takeaway. And November is, of course, the month when we go to the polls. But it's also the month when, if you have health care coverage through your employer, you often get a chance to change it through open enrollment. And it appears that those options through open enrollment are kind of narrowing because premiums are going through the roof and coverage seems to be shrinking. Here to talk about this today is Beth Kobliner. She's a Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. But first, let's go to our two other guests quickly. Marva Allen is the co-owner of the Human Bookstore in Harlem, and Walt Rowan is owner of the Susquehanna Glass Company that's based out of Columbia, Pennsylvania. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So quickly, let's just get a check on healthcare coverage real quickly. Marva, you own a bookstore in Harlem, and you provide health insurance for two full-time employees. How much has the cost of coverage gone up for you this year?
Oh, it's gone up about 140% from last year.
140%.
140%, and the coverage has gone down.
Okay, so how many healthcare insurance companies have you actually switched to or changed from with your employees over the last 10 years?
Yes, Celeste, I'd say in the last 10 years, we had probably 8 different insurance companies.
Wow.
Just about every year we have to change.
And is that because of rising premiums?
Well, in the last 4 years, as an example, we had a if we hadn't changed or done anything, we had a 22%, 24%, and then a 10% increase. Those were the last three. And now this year, we would have had a 128% increase.
Okay. Well, this is we're going to hear a cut from Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon talking about this.
It's open enrollment right now, and it looks like people who have coverage are going to take another big hit. With higher premiums, more out-of-pocket expenses, more deductibles.
So, Beth, here we hear three stories, and they all sound
all the way around.
Similar.
You know, it used to be open enrollment was a happy time that you pick among your choices of health insurance, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
Right. Each one could be better.
Now you have one choice, typically. You know, most people only have one choice, which is no choice at all. You have to go with what you get. And within that, it's probably a lot more expensive and you have a lot fewer options. You might not have, you know, basic things covered that you used to have covered. And that's why it's so important to pay attention. Even though you don't have the choice, you have to look to see what's covered. Is your doctor still covered under your plan? Because he or she may not be anymore.
So the network changes.
The network changes. You may not have chiropractic services covered. Your spouse may now have an extra fee in order to be covered. There are all kinds of little changes that take place, and your premiums have gone up a little bit for individuals. You know, the average single person now pays $65 a month, premium being, you know, I know these terms, I see both of your eyes glaze over. I say premium, I say deductible, people get, you know, kind of bored by the whole thing. You're with me. Premiums are what you pay. The average premium for a single person is $65
a month.
The monthly amount. It's $293 per month for a family. Now, this, again, remember, is what the employee pays. So the employer is paying about 80% of that. But deductibles are increasing rather dramatically for a family. It's $1,500 a year. Now, a deductible is what you have to pay out of pocket.
That's your cash flow before,
exactly.
before the insurance even kicks in.
And you have to choose between HMOs, which are much more restrictive. You often can't go outside of the network, but cheaper, and they don't have deductibles. So they're not as much out-of-pocket expenses generally, versus PPOs, which are preferred provider organizations, where you can go outside of a network, and you can, but it does cost you a little bit more, and you'll have deductibles. So there are all these choices, but you may not have the choice, but you have to look within your plan to see what's covered for you.
So Marva, let me ask you, you hear us talking about the differences between, you know, maybe choosing an HMO to make it cheaper, or maybe choosing something with a higher deductible to make it cheaper. Are there options for you to make it cheaper for your business to provide this insurance?
No, not really. You know, I wish I paid $65.
Yeah.
I pay $344 a month.
Right.
For my particular policy, and for two people, $688 a month. And, you know, to be quite honest, I don't even know what's covered, you know. I mean, it's just ridiculous, and my deductible is $1,000.
Wow. Let me just ask you one question there. Listening to Marva's, predicament there with those high premiums. Mm-hmm. Years ago, the big industrial companies in the United States ditched a lot of their insurance programs entirely and just covered their workers by putting cash aside. Is that something that's an option for you?
Well, what we've done is every year, we added a deductible about 4 years ago. And initially, the company paid the full amount of the deductible for the employees. So they were only getting maybe a 10% increase in their premium every year, but we were paying for the deductible. But we've been increasing the deductible every year. It started at $1,000, went to $1,200, then $1,500.
Wow.
This year it's going to $2,000.
Right.
But we can't pay the deductible this year because our premium increases are somewhere in the neighborhood of $22,000 just for the whole year.
So, Beth, you know, there are people do get often choices between whether they're going to have full coverage or a lower premium in the deductible, or a lot of people are going to catastrophic care in order to save money.
Right. If you are in the situation where you do have a choice, and the choice that is coming up is these catastrophic plans, meaning that you have a very large deductible, you have to pay maybe $3,000, $4,000 before any insurance kicks in. In that case, you have to be prepared for the fact that you will be paying a lot of money out of pocket for just general doctor's visits.
Yeah.
And the problem with that, of course, is, you know, if I have a kid who has a sore throat, do I bring him in for a strep test because it's going to cost me a couple of $100 out of pocket? And that's the problem. I think that's the problem. And that's, of course, why we need this health insurance reform that everybody's talking about.
But that won't kick in until 2013.
Yes.
So it's not going to help anybody anytime
soon. It's a huge, huge issue, and I think people are really feeling it now.
Beth Koebleiner is a Takeaway contributor, of course, and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Marva Allen, co-owner of the Human Bookstore in Harlem, and Walt Rowan joined us from his home in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, owner of Susquehanna Glass. To read a chapter of Beth Koebleiner's book, Get a Financial Life, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Did you know the food stamp program serves 36 million people? Here's Leah's story.
Boy, was I ever glad to be an American citizen when I came back from studying abroad 6 months pregnant. No health insurance, no work, and thankfully Medicaid was able to pay for the delivery of my daughter in a wonderful suburban hospital and with backup care for an entire year to take care of her.
Government helping hands. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
In 1968, a persistent TV interviewer and a mumbly schoolboy changed the world.
Well, when you get to school, what do you have to eat there?
Yes.
You don't have anything to eat when you're at school?
Yes.
Are you ashamed?
Yes, it's hard.
Why are you ashamed?
A 40-year-old CBS documentary on hunger shamed America into creating the modern food stamp program. Today, there's no shame in food stamps, which have become a huge part of the U.S. agricultural economy. But these days, by the age of 20, half of all kids in the U.S., it's estimated, will have received assistance from food stamps. 36 million and counting. Easy money in hard times on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, November 3rd, Election Day. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John. Coming up, House Democrats hope to vote on health care this week, and Republicans seem to be using the same arguments that we heard all summer long. Also, who's to blame when a kid's failing in school? The kid? The parents? The teacher? A lesson in trickle-up responsibility from Texas, and we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Timothy Egan about his newest book and how an enormous wildfire in 1910 saved America.
But first, Angel Seymour, up in the Bronx, living alone. You've been on food stamps for over a year. Angel, did you realize you're one of 36 million people receiving food stamps?
Yes, I do.
Does that mean that food stamps are mainstream, no big deal, not with a stigma like they used to have in the past?
It's a very big deal. Obviously, we are losing a lot of jobs. There's not a lot of jobs out there. We are not able to afford food. We're not able to afford our rent and so forth like we used to. A lot of things have gone downhill these past couple of years, and we need to find out why.
Well, let's get to the bottom of it. Angel Seymour will stay with us in a moment. The challenges with food stamps in the middle of the recession, we're going to talk about it. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, voters across the country are heading to the polls for Election Day today. They're choosing governors in Virginia, New Jersey, and mayors in 380 cities, including right here in New York. In economic news, Warren Buffett's company Berkshire Hathaway is buying the railroad firm Burlington Northern in a deal worth $34 billion. It's also taking on $10 billion of Northern's debt. In a written statement, Warren Buffett called the deal a, quote, all-in wager on the economic future of the United States.
It's not all in with Warren Buffett. He still has about $20 billion left in his pocket. Overseas, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has invited the Taliban to take part in peace talks. He says he wants an inclusive government. He was declared winner of the Afghan presidential election yesterday. In baseball, the World Series is moving back to the Bronx after the Phillies beat the Yankees 8-6 last night. The Yankees still lead the series 3-2. The teams meet in Game 6 tomorrow night. Wall Street up a tiny bit yesterday. The Dow starts trading at 97.89. The S&P kicks off at 10.43. The NASDAQ at 20.49. Futures trading suggests a negative opening when Wall Street gets underway in about a half hour. So, people on food stamps, 36 million of them. What do you feel about a government handout? One of the most popular government programs, food stamps, has prevented severe hunger, but is it creating other problems? We're going to talk about that in a moment. How do you feel about getting a helping hand from the government? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Well, we got something to talk about this morning. I mean, all these windy discussions and sort of goofy economic notions of public options and the marketplace. I mean, the public option for 36 million Americans is food stamps.
There's a
public option. Food stamps, of course, a program that was born in a time of horrific poverty and malnutrition. It has grown in more than four decades to serve 36 million Americans, but at a time where childhood obesity is talked about as much as poverty and malnutrition. So is this one of the most successful programs in U.S. history? Is its growth a sign that poverty actually persists and is growing? Or has the recession somehow skewed the impact of this multi-billion dollar program, which helps families? It affects the price of food throughout the U.S. economy. Is it helping or hurting? What are we to make of these statistics that are coming out that says that half of U.S. children by the age of 20 will have been on food stamps at
You don't know if it's alarming or not.
Well,
I mean, you don't know what to make of it, but it's surprising.
We got the right people to talk about it. Joel Berg is here in the studio, executive director of New York City Coalition Against Hunger, author of the book All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
You heard Angel Seymour there, single woman from the Bronx who's on food stamps. You still there, Angel?
Yes, I am.
All right, well, let's begin with Mark Rank, who's a professor of social welfare at Washington University in St. Louis, one of the authors of this new food stamp study, which shows just how entrenched this program is in the U.S. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Is this a sign of food stamps' success that 36 million Americans are getting food stamps? Have we eradicated the kinds of poverty that motivated the program in the beginning?
No, I think what it really is a sign of is the amount of economic need that's out there. When you have, you know, half of all U.S. children at some point being in a household that receives food stamps, it's really a sign of households that are by definition in poverty and also are food insecure. And so I think what these findings indicate is a real wake-up call to America that we have a lot of kids at some point during childhood that are in economic trouble.
And if food stamps are a safety net, there's some holes in it. Listen to this voice from a listener that we heard from last month.
This is Chrissy from Miami, Florida. I have food stamps for my two daughters and I, $200 a month. We're not making it.
Joel Berg, is someone like Chrissy there in Florida, when she gets her food stamps at the beginning of the month, if she can't make it, on her way to one of your programs by the end of the month?
There is no question that because food stamps benefits are far lower than the actual cost of living, the actual cost of eating, tens of millions of Americans both use food stamps benefits and soup kitchens and food pantries. As an advocate, I would say that's a failure of the food stamps program. It really should help people eat not only enough food, but enough nutritious food.
All right. So what are the gymnastics? Angel Seymour, how do you have to plan your month? To get through the month, if food stamps come at the beginning, I remember when I had food stamps as a college student, and you don't feel sorry for me, but it required a certain amount of planning to make that work for a month. What's it like for you?
It's the same thing. I have to plan. I have to have my grocery list ready ahead of time, and still, you know, it's hard to really make it because the prices of food is high.
Now, can I ask you some maybe slightly personal questions here, Angel?
Yeah.
Do you have access to refrigeration?
Yes, I do.
And you got an electric bill that's paid, right? So you can actually buy food and freeze it, right?
Yeah.
All right, that's a help, correct?
Yeah, but it's still not really very good because, you can't have your food frozen too long.
All right. Mark Rank, what kinds of gymnastics or sense of planning do people have to go through to make food stamps work out? And some would say that's a good thing. It shouldn't be all impulse buying food.
Well, I think if you talk to, you know, as Angel just indicated, if you talk to anybody who's using food stamps, what you find is that by the end of the second or third week, the benefits have run out. And so, you know, people have to be extremely frugal in planning their diet. And the ironic thing is to purchase a healthy, nutritious diet with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables is actually expensive to do. So I was just talking to somebody, and we were talking about Whole Foods, and they said, you know, instead of Whole Foods, the name should be Whole Paycheck, because you wind up spending right. so much money trying to get these kinds of foods. So that's why you see folks in poverty often wind up buying the types of food that fills you up, but really isn't good for you in the long run.
And that's my question for you, Joel Berg, because, I mean, obviously you don't have to shop at Whole Foods. You can get produce without getting organic. But it is very expensive, and many people who are on food stamps say they can't afford to buy fresh produce. They have to buy canned food and boxed food and things like that. So how do you balance the real healthcare needs of getting people to eat healthy food with the fact that the food stamp budget for each one is relatively low?
Well, first, it's important to note the tens of millions of Americans in urban and rural areas live in food deserts that don't even have fresh produce, that don't even have whole grain bread, that don't even have skim milk. And if they do, they are not affordable. 2 years ago, sort of a stunt, I lived on a food stamps budget for a week. It was $28.30 of food for the week. I live in Brooklyn across from one of the best farmers markets on the planet. I could not afford a farmers market apple that week for 50 cents. I could only afford a mealy apple across the street for 30 cents. I couldn't afford a single beverage. I dramatically cut down on my fruit and vegetable and whole grain consumption. So it is a very real issue that nutrition is one of the prime reasons why people are both hungry and obese.
Wow, that's interesting. Angel Seymour, tell us how food stamps, if at all, if this is your experience, channel you into making decisions on nutrition that aren't good for you?
Well, it's very hard to do so, like Mr. Berg said, and it's almost impossible at times because the cost of nutritious food is either not available in the area, and where you do find it, it's expensive.
Well, let me get down to brass tacks then. Angel Seymour, how far do you have to walk to get a 40-ounce soda?
A 40-ounce soda doesn't exist in my area, anywhere
a large
around
soda.
My area.
A large one, a big soda, soft drink.
The soft drink is 75 cents and up.
And it's on your block?
Yes.
What about getting some fresh celery, lettuce, or maybe any sort of organic produce? How far would you have to go?
Oh, I would have to go way across town.
All right. Well, geographically, that sort of says it right there. Mark Rank, is this an example of the economy just sort of outgrowing the food stamp program and it's time for some reforms? Or has the program itself deliberately made an incomplete statement and deliberately kept people away from being as healthy as they might be?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. When the food stamp program came about, there was a lot of discussion about really making it somewhat difficult for people to get the program, stigmatizing people by using the food stamps, this kind of thing. But I think in the last few years, the United States Department of Agriculture has really tried to be broader in terms of their outreach. People now have a debit card instead of the stamps. So I think to the credit of the program, it has tried to reach out and touch a wider segment of the population. The other thing I should say about the food stamp program, it's one of the few safety net programs that we have in this country that actually lots of different folks are eligible for. So you could be elderly, you could be a married couple, you could be a single person. All these kinds of folks can apply and possibly get food stamps, whereas a lot of the welfare programs we have, you have to be a single mom with kids in order to get that program.
Angel Seymour, is the fact that you are a food stamp recipient have a stigma? Is that a problem for you in stores, in public?
Well, yeah, it is. We're treated like lowlifes because we're on
food stamps and so forth. And the thing is that they treat us like we haven't worked our lives, that we're not trying to better our lives.
When you say they treat you that way, who do you get that feeling from?
Store owners. A lot of stores are still not accepting those EBT cards. For one thing, they haven't even signed up for those programs. They don't want to get involved. They're worried that, oh, they'll get robbed and all this kind of stuff.
Angel,
but seriously, it's not as accessible and helpful as it's been brought out to be.
Right. Angel, last personal question. What's your allotment? How much in food stamps do you get per month?
I get $200 a month.
$200 a month. Angel Seymour, good luck to you. Single woman from the Bronx who's been on food stamps for a year. And thanks so much for being a part of the program. Joel Berg, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. Final thought, Joel?
I just say the state of the current food stamps program is both a massive success, that it's increased when the economy's gone down as it's intended to do, and also still a work in progress because the benefits do need to be expanded to make the food more nutritious.
Thank you, Joel. And we also spoke with Mark Rank, a professor of social welfare at Washington University, who is one of the authors of the new food stamp study, which says that half of all kids in the U.S. will be on food stamps at one time or another before they're age 20. Thank you, Professor Rank.
Thank you very much.
Hey, you want that to go?
Yeah, I need a takeout on healthcare, and we're going to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent down in Washington, where House Democrats are still hoping to vote on their healthcare reform bill later in the week. But Todd, you know, the Republicans are sounding a little like a town meeting that we heard last August. Listen.
What you're looking at here, undeniably, is a government takeover of health care in America. We think when the American people see the facts, they'll know that, and I think they'll be even more drawn to the Republican alternative.
Well, our goal is to make this as difficult as possible to vote for, because we think this bill is the wrong prescription for what ails our health care system in America.
That sounds really bipartisan there, Todd.
Well, ask the Republicans in the House if Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats have been bipartisan, and they would tell you they've been shut out of this process. So they need to be loud, and they need to be a little bit disruptive to get heard on this. So House Republicans, John, are planning a big push this week on Capitol Hill, in the media, all over the place, to try to get heard on health reform. They're having conservative talk radio people up on the Hill. They're having a reading room where people can come in and read the bill, and members will make comments on it. One Republican member on the floor yesterday saying that this health reform bill was more dangerous to Americans than any terrorist. Huh. So they're playing both sides of it. They're trying to be positive with the message that they have a better alternative. Also, maybe some of the old rhetoric from the town hall days. Both of those things coming in this week.
But don't Republicans really need a marketing campaign that's going to have rhetoric different from what Mike Pence, Republican of Indiana, was saying there in that cut, that it's a government takeover of health care, or what John Boehner, Republican of Ohio, was saying, that the American people will turn this down, hands down, even though the polling data suggests otherwise?
Well, maybe they do. They're going to try both sides of this. You are hearing some of the rhetoric, like those cuts that you just played off the top there, John. But Celeste, you were asking last week, what's the Republicans' plan? What's their alternative? And this week, the Republicans say they do have their alternative that they will be rolling out by the end of the week, that does include their ideas, like in cutting state insurance mandates that do cover things that we like, you know, like mammography screening and 24-hour maternity stays, but they do raise costs, making it easier to buy insurance across state lines, getting rid of frivolous medical malpractice lawsuits that do raise costs. So Republicans say they have an alternative that doesn't raise the deficit and doesn't raise taxes. We don't know how much it will cost yet, because they haven't had an analysis finished yet. So they're doing it on both sides, the rhetorical side, but also hoping to show an alternative. And also, let's be fair, you know, we've said before, the minority's job in the House is to snipe and criticize, because they don't usually get a vote. It's not like
right.
The Senate, you know, so this is sort of their job, even though it's tough to hear sometimes. This is what they were made to do.
And the question is, will they be able to seize any momentum with their own alternative by the end of the week? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Now for a business takeout with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. And speaking of the New York Times, here's the story in the paper.
Well, I was shopping for a new car. Which one's me? A cool convertible or an SUV? Too bad I didn't know my credit was whack, because now I'm driving off the lot in a used subcompact FREE. That spells free. CreditReport.com, baby.
My kids saw their sing this
song. It's very catchy. It is very catchy. So the Times is looking at these guys and how if it's really a truly a free credit report, how these companies are making money. So yep. What did we find out?
Well, that's a commercial from Experian. And, you know, Experian has two websites. And here's a question for you guys. One is called freecreditreport.com and one is called annualcreditreport.com. Which one do you think is free?
Gee,
it's not the one free. It's the annual credit report. So let's say this slowly again so everyone can hear. If you want a free credit report, don't go to freecreditreport.com. Go to annualcreditreport.com. And this has been a long-running battle with
that
the FTC.
Crazy.
It is crazy.
And expensive creditreport.com. They actually pay you, right? So that, if that's the logic there.
That would be nice. That would be nice. But it's a serious problem, and all the more so because right now, with the recession, a lot of people are having credit problems.
Absolutely.
And people are even more likely now to sign up for this sort of thing because they want to make sure that they don't run into trouble with their credit. And so what we found is that the FTC has been in this battle with Experian, the company that runs this not free website, and has been trying to get them to make it more clear. For example, they have a proposal, the FTC has a proposal that Experian would need to have people who go to this website bounced to the free one for a short time and just notified that the other one is free. And a lot of people who sign up for this monitoring service, and what they charge you for is they monitor your credit constantly, don't realize they're doing that, so they end up paying $14.95 a month.
For the monitoring,
which if you've had identity theft is really good to know if someone's stolen, you know, your identity, but it's not needed for most people and they end up canceling it. And so this is why Experian runs those catchy commercials to lure in more people to what's becoming a $1 billion business.
Looks like we may get some kind of a reform in the credit reporting agencies. That's Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Not free. Creditreport.com just isn't as catchy a song, apparently. All right, so our sports takeaway comes from takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So the Phillies are storming up to the Bronx. The Yankees are licking their wounds. But hey, the headline is the New Orleans Saints last night still undefeated. Can anyone stop this football team?
Well, and it's funny that you talk about the Phillies. A lot of Yankee fans were actually rooting for the Phillies to win because they wanted to see the Yankees play in New York. So as soon as they saw the Mark Teixeira whiff and end that game, they turned over to see Michael Turner, who ran for 151 yards in 20 attempts. He scored a touchdown. This guy was a beast. And if you've ever seen football players on TV, you see like a big scrum. They run into the thing and then they get stopped and it's pretty boring. Michael Turner, he just goes right into it, and he busts through like he's like the Hulk, and he goes charging down the field.
But the Atlanta Falcons couldn't stop the New Orleans Saints. They fell 35-27, Atlanta playing New Orleans. I mean, the Saints are undefeated and are really looking like an unstoppable force in football right now.
Precisely. I think Drew Brees, as we said time and time again, is like the Michael Jordan, the LeBron James. He is the premier player in NFL right now. However, in the past couple games, he's had six turnovers. He's had four interceptions and two fumbles. So he is a little human, and that's the thing about the New Orleans Saints. They figure out ways to win even when their offense isn't clicking on all cylinders.
On their schedule, what is a team that could conceivably stop them? I mean, we've seen their average score is something like in the 40s.
Yeah, they've scored 273 points this season. That's the fourth most in the NFL through seven games in history.
In history, right.
And this is their best start in their history. The tie's their best start in history of their season, of their career, of the franchise. But they play on November 30th, New England Patriots. That is the game that is the only team. They have a patsy schedule pretty much up until then.
Yeah, and the next contest is with Carolina, right?
And that's another team that they should stomp over. I'm saying this right now, and I've said it from the beginning of the season, is that the New Orleans Saints are the best team in NFL.
All right, watch the Saints if you're sick of the Yankees winning baseball. Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much.
Thanks. Good morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up in a moment, when a student fails, who's at fault? Is it the teacher or the teacher's teacher? That may be what Texas is beginning to think and getting ready to punish the teachers of teachers. We'll talk more in a few minutes. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. It's Election Day. New Jersey and Virginia are electing governors. There'll also be 380 mayoral elections around the country, including New York and Atlanta. And in Maine, voters will decide whether to repeal a state law that allows gay marriage.
A report out today shows that half of American children will have been in a household receiving food stamps by the time they reach 20 years old. Speaking on The Takeaway earlier, one of the food stamp study's authors, Mark Rank, said the statistics about kids are a sign of how many households are, quote, food insecure.
So I think what these findings indicate is a real wake-up call to America that we have a lot of kids at some point during childhood that are in economic trouble.
Professor Rank from George Washington University in St. Louis says the food stamp program has grown to serve an estimated 36 million Americans. In baseball, the World Series heads to the Bronx for Game 6 tomorrow, and those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So if my son at school comes home with a bad report card, I generally think it's because he's not getting his homework done and is playing too many video games. It's going to take a lot for me to get the kind of evidence that I need to say that it's the teacher's fault that he's not doing well in school or on his tests. But in Texas, they're even going one step further. It's not just the teacher's fault in Texas, but right now they're saying it could be the teacher's fault. Under a proposed new rating system, the schools that teach teachers would get punished if those teachers don't do well on the job. That means bad grades by a student could point to the teacher's...
Are you banging the table?
I'm banging the teacher. I'm trying to understand this system.
Mad but as help. Hell. I can't take it anymore.
I'm not mad, John. Yeah, I'm just trying to understand. Sure. Erica Mellon is going to explain this to us. Right, Erica? You're going to make this all clear. She's the education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Good morning. Okay, make this clear to me. How does this program work?
Well, I hope, not sure I can make you stop tapping on that table, but basically Texas, in an ongoing effort to try and improve student achievement, is going to start holding their colleges of education and other teacher training programs accountable. For the first time in the state, basically Texas is going to look at whether their graduates are able to boost students' test scores. They're going to survey the school principals, see if they're doing a good job.
What's causing this? There's an epidemic of horrible teachers in Texas?
I'm not sure about that, but there's been some concern over the years in Texas that a lot of alternative teaching programs have been popping up in the state. Some of these are run by for-profit companies. There's been some concern that some of these programs are not producing top-quality teachers.
So, when you say alternative, you mean not a college, a university, community college, something like that?
Mostly not. Some colleges do run them, but mostly for-profit companies, and basically these programs can fast-track teachers on the job.
Okay, Dan Ariely joins us. He's a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He's the author of Predictably Irrational. So the reason that Dan is here is to kind of talk to us about how sometimes the ideas have unforeseen circumstances. Right, Dan?
That's right.
So you hear about this program that Erica is telling us about from Texas in terms of trying to kind of crack down on alternative teaching programs by holding teaching training programs responsible for the performance of students.
And I get very worried. And I think it's kind of an ideology that we have that the moment we put money into the equation, everything becomes good all of a sudden. But in reality, there's no reason to expect it to get better or to get better very quickly. And let me give you some examples. The first thing is to ask the question of how much control do the teachers have over their kids' performance. You can say it's a 10%, 15%, 20%, but for sure you will not get to 100%. So now what you're saying is let's reward teachers based on performance that are largely is outside of their control. So from their perspective, it's random. By the way, we do this all the time, right? We give CEOs salary that are tightly related to their stock performance where they, in fact, don't have perfect control over their company's
right.
performance.
That's
so true. That's a good point.
It's not something new. But what it means is that the teachers are really working in a random environment. Imagine that you were walking around the street and you were trying to figure things out, and I would reward you, some based on your performance, but some based on random things that are not out of your control. And what we know is that when people are facing this kind of environment, their learning ability gets much, much lower. So people basically are not able to learn and figure things out, because imagine, 1 month you do something like this, it should have worked better, but in reality, other things in the market happen and it actually works worse. So that's the first thing.
Okay.
We're rewarding people.
Right.
The second thing is that this interacts with the No Child Left Behind policy. So we have this policy that really ties teachers' hands in terms of what they can and can't do. And all of a sudden we're saying...
Right, because they're having to prepare for a test, right.
That's right. And what we also know from No Child Left Behind is that teachers are really good in preparing people for tests. It just doesn't always fit with the objective of learning. So one of the lessons from the No Child Left Behind is if you give teachers a test, they will could really teach the test and test scores could go up, but they don't go up for an equivalent test that the kids should have done well on as well.
Okay, so Erica, the teachers very often had a lot of criticism for the No Child Left Behind program, but it sounds like in Texas the teachers support this idea of the Teachers Teachers program.
Well, yes, I was a little bit surprised about this. What I found was that the idea of teachers being personally responsible for their students' test scores has been more controversial. But the idea of holding the teachers' teachers accountable, these teacher preparation programs, that has been less controversial.
You know, one of the things, Dan, that it puzzles me here is that I read once that they talked at one point about having teachers of pilots be held accountable for mistakes in the cockpit. And the net effect of that was to say, well, then there are going to be no teachers of pilots ever. So the unintended consequences of this could actually reduce the number of teachers of teachers, right?
Well, you know, I don't know if there will be less of them, because I don't know what will be the repercussions and how long it will take. But I think it will definitely make them worried, right? Imagine, you know, I teach in a business school, and imagine that you will blame me from Wall Street, right? And all of a sudden you say, hey, you know, you taught some kids who then went ahead and worked on Wall Street. I think you're partially responsible. Now you would think about, what will I teach? And will I basically not take any new chances and not teach anything new? Because one of the things we know is that a defense from a legal system is, I just did what everybody else does as well. This is kind of the acceptable practice. I didn't do anything different. So it might reduce any flexibility, any nuances, any innovation, and so on.
Well, these accountability programs make you feel good, though.
Really? I have kind of an uneasy feeling about it. That's Dan Ariely. He's a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University and author of Predictably Irrational. We also heard from Erica Mellon. She's education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Coming up about 100 years ago, an enormous wildfire completely devastated a swath of land in the West that was the size of Connecticut. And from that, the modern conservation movement began. Really? We're going to get more on that from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Timothy Egan later this hour.
Up from the ashes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The newly reelected Afghan President Hamid Karzai held his first press conference and called on his quote-unquote Taliban brothers to take part in peace talks.
My government will be for all Afghans, and all those who want to work with me are most welcome, regardless of whether they opposed me in the election or whether they supported me in the election.
But the Taliban called Karzai a puppet in a statement they released, and they also declared the canceling of the runoff as a victory of their own. We spoke earlier this morning to the BBC's Kabul correspondent, Ian Pannell. We asked him if we should take this invitation by Hamid Karzai for the Taliban to join him in peace talks seriously.
Well, I think there are a number of points here. The first is that this isn't the first time that Hamid Karzai has said something that may at first blush appear unpalatable to people in America or in Britain for that matter. In the past, for example, he's even appealed to Mullah Omar to come to Kabul and to engage in talks. I think he is sincere in wanting to reach out to the Taliban. I think you have to see this in an Afghan context, although for us it sounds very odd for him to be talking about Taliban brothers. But the feeling certainly amongst the political class here and amongst ordinary Afghans, and all opinion polls show this, is that the only way to really bring some form of peace and stability to this country is by sitting down and talking. And this is shown time and again when you talk to people, and it's shown in opinion polls, that they don't believe there's a military solution here. They don't want more foreign troops here. They think in a classically Afghan way, people should sit down and talk. However opposed they may have been in the past, enemies in the past have sat down and talked together. Many enemies are now sitting in the current Afghan government, probably the new government. And so for them, I think they see this as fairly ordinary.
So maybe we still will see that. But what about his other promise in terms of rooting out corruption? Let's kind of bypass for the moment the fact that he's admitting that there's rampant corruption in the government. Do you think that particular promise is sincere?
Well, I think it has to be for any chance of success in the country. Let's be under no doubt that there is considerable pressure now being applied from Washington and from London and elsewhere in the international community, all those with a vested interest in trying to see some form of progress in Afghanistan, for Hamid Karzai to step up to the plate, to try and do something meaningful to root out corruption. But here's the dilemma. Hamid Karzai has now been re-elected in an even weaker position than he was during his first administration. And there was pressure at that time from the international community, from America and also from Britain, on him to try and root out certain key ministers, to try and root out corruption in his government. Key individuals have been identified by newspapers, by magazines, and also by politicians. So we know who these people are. The question is whether or not he has the political capital to be able to do anything meaningful. And I think that there's a real doubt about that,
especially with the Taliban calling him a puppet. Is that just the Taliban, or is that the opinion of Afghan citizens?
Well, I think many people, many ordinary people, also think that, and we've been hearing that even today out on the streets talking to people. They feel that the international community has absolutely dictated the terms of this. If you're an ordinary Afghan, you don't understand why the international community, Senate, led by Senator John Kerry, forced the Afghans into a second round only days later to turn around and say, actually, there's no need for one.
Ian Pannell is the BBC Kabul correspondent who joined us earlier this morning from Afghanistan.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, Timothy Egan's brand new fabulous book called The Big Burn is about something that happened in 1910 that resonates today. Here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour, though. Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, is buying the railroad firm Burlington Northern in a deal worth $34 billion. It's also taking on $10 billion of Northern's debt, the biggest acquisition ever for Berkshire Hathaway. Overseas, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has appealed to what he called his Taliban brothers to take part in peace talks. He also said he would tackle corruption in his next term in office.
In the World Series, the Phillies beat the Yankees 8-6 last night. The Yankees still lead the series 3-2. The teams will meet again tomorrow night. And today is voting day in New York's 23rd congressional district, the northernmost district of New York. Moderate Republican Didi Scozzafava withdrew from that race and then endorsed the Democrat candidate over the conservative Republican. And she claimed that one of the reasons she made those moves, withdrew from the race, is because of hateful speech on the part of Republican right-wing conservatives. And Rush Limbaugh fired back with some talk about what he calls rhinos. Rhinos here in this, where he's talking about, is Republicans in name only.
Didi Scozzafava is illustrating precisely what moderate Republicans will do and who moderate Republicans are.
So, Brian Mann, you're with us. He's a reporter for North Country Public Radio. The cut from Rush Limbaugh in which he calls out Scozzafava is bringing people to the polls?
Yeah, this is definitely a passion builder for the Democrats. They're using everything that they can to get their people excited to try to match the fervor on the conservative side, which has been building for weeks. And, you know, Rush, you know, it might backfire a bit, getting them fired up as well.
And then they weren't before.
It's been a tough one for the Democrats. They've seen this divide on the other side that's built up so much energy among Republicans and conservatives, and the Democrat just ran a quieter race, not the kind of thing that sort of gets the barn on fire. So, yeah, they definitely needed something to prod people to the polls.
Okay, we'll see how that works out. Thanks, Brian Mann, as a reporter for North Country Public Radio.
So often in American history, it's been some great disaster that has produced a sea change in the way we see the world around us. Tragic events that generate social and cultural upheavals that ripple far out into the future, past even the memory of that original disaster. For instance, if you go to any national park or wilderness in the United States today, you will find the friendly, heroic figure of the forest ranger, a uniformed custodian of the natural splendor of the United States and a watcher for forest fires. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Timothy Egan, 100 years ago, how did the people of the West view this idea of a uniformed federal forest ranger?
Well, good morning, and it's great to be with you. They were against it. The Rangers were these, you know, enemy, these people out of Yale, these kids full of this great crusade of Teddy Roosevelt, and they go out,
invaders. They were like,
yeah, exactly. They were seen as these, you know, Eastern elite sissies, Green Rangers, all these things, and they chased them out of the woods. They killed a ranger, and they mistook him for a deer.
Well, the story of how all that changed is the subject of Tim Egan's new book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. It's about a disastrous wildfire in 1910 that burned an area in Montana and Idaho the size of Connecticut. It's a gripping story of how the modern conservation movement, it can be said, today's entire green movement in some respects, was born in a conflagration that changed the way America looked at land and vindicated an idea big Teddy Roosevelt had imposed on America when he was president. First of all, why this fire?
Well, there's been nothing like it, just in pure terms of ferocity, size, five towns burned to the ground, 3 million acres, 36 hours, a day and a half, as you said, the size of Connecticut. And I was originally drawn to it just for the cool, natural disaster part of it. But then the backstory really drew me in. Roosevelt, the only native of New York City ever to be president, who said later he wanted to steer the Republican Party into a fairly radical, progressive party. Those were his words. And the key to that was the public lands dream. He set aside an area about the size of France for all Americans. This was the public land endowment that we all have as part of our democracy.
At a time when American wealth was based on grabbing land in the very same area of the West.
Precisely. This was the last clash of the big Gilded Age powers. They all had their headquarters here in New York City. And they did not want to, they wanted to get their hands on this timber, this mining wealth, et cetera. So they opposed Roosevelt. Roosevelt leads office. The public lands dream is orphaned. His chief forester is fired. This is 1910, almost 100 years ago next year. And these rangers are being run out of the woods. So they're being harassed by a hostile Congress, his fellow Republican Party that wants to defund the Forest Service. These Gilded Age powers are after him, these E.H. Harrimans, all these people we know now mainly as philanthropies. and they're being chased out of the woods as well.
Then, that's before the fire.
This is leading up to the eve of the fire.
So the betting is, here's this federal program that Roosevelt created. These rangers are in the woods. It's kind of a symbolic program. Taft gets elected president. Roosevelt is out. And the whole thing is like, never mind about that silliness. We're not going to be serious about that. And then the fire happens.
Exactly. And it's, you know, they find these Deadwood-like cities in the woods. They find these brothels, these miners, these people who are just, you know, chasing them everywhere. And when the fire happens, it's catastrophic. I mean, it's 70-mile-an-hour winds, which are hurricane-force winds that knock you down. And it's a blow-up. It's a beast of its own. It's a thing that feeds on its own weather system. But it has the ironic effect of making mythic heroes. It's sort of their creation myth of the young rangers. They've died in battle.
They were largely immigrants. Mostly immigrants.
They're black soldiers. The
Buffalo soldiers.
Buffalo soldiers, who were almost double the African-American population of the state of Idaho when they're sent there.
Right.
They're poor Italians. This is the peak of Italian immigration. I traced two people back to their village in Italy.
Which is an incredible story all by itself.
Right.
In the book.
Yeah, and they're treated really poorly when they come here, too, and they sort of cast around the West. They go to work for Teddy's Big Great Dream for 25 cents an hour. So they die, these soldiers die, and they're all led by these young rangers, most of whom are in their 20s, just out of college. And Roosevelt, a superb politician, then storms the West, pounds his bully pulpit, which he invented, by the way, that term, his favorite expression, and makes, as any good politician will do, makes events into policy, makes it into narrative. Makes it in, you know, and has the effect of making mythic heroes of these people, and single-handedly using this fire, using this event, turns public sentiment.
Let's listen to some of the rare actual recordings of Teddy Roosevelt's voice. This is from August 1912. Listen.
I believe in the right of the people to rule. I believe that the majority of the plain people of the United States will, day in and day out, make fewer mistakes in governing themselves than any smaller class or body of men, no matter what their training, will make in trying to govern.
So in the crucible of fire, this huge figure, Teddy Roosevelt, creates this political movement that becomes the conservation movement of today and turns the Rangers into heroes. do we really need a Teddy Roosevelt today to actually deal with the environmental problems that are maybe even more severe than saving the lands back in 1910?
Someone said in the review of the Washington Post of this book that what Barack Obama is trying to do with health care right now is analogous to what Roosevelt did with the conservation dream. It was a huge experiment. It was radical, and he had pushback at all levels. Roosevelt actually wanted to have a global summit on the environment. That was his last thing he wanted to do 100 years ago, similar to what Merkel is going to be talking about today in the Congress.
Right, the German chancellor.
Exactly what they're trying to do. He wanted to get all the nations together. They didn't call it climate change. He said, let's just take stock of this planet that we share. He was so ahead of his time in that way. Now, the difference between him and most leaders is this guy, you heard his voice, it doesn't really match the image of the face, does it?
No.
But he knew how to move public sentiment.
And let's talk about the public sentiment. I mean, you say in this book, and convince me, that every American changed the way they looked at land. It wasn't a commodity anymore. It was a national trust.
Right. It was two things, really, John. They believed that American democracy could not be complete without the public land part of it, that Jefferson gave us all, all men are created equal, the initial philosophical push. But the second half of it was the public lands endowment, the idea that the little guy, that's what they always called it, the little guy, owns a piece of this big chunk of what was left over from Louisiana Purchase. And that was to counter the Gilded Age, these powers, this concentration of wealth, which had never been so great until just a few years ago.
Until now.
Right, exactly. So I love all those echoes from the immigration part of it, the Gilded Age part of it.
The environment part of it, and also the fight over the identity of the Republican Party, which we're seeing again as well.
And in fact, the split that happened after this set the course for the Republican Party for the next 100 years. The progressive left, the Democrats, which were largely the base of racists, South, anti-conservation, the party roles completely flipped over the course of 100 years.
So when we see these CNN pictures of wildfires in California and the West, it's echoes from all these fires that are still burning.
I'm glad you asked that, because thereafter they vowed to put out every fire. And what the net result was, they had all this fuel buildup, all these trees that should fire's part of nature.
Thank you, Timothy Egan, for being on the show this morning. The Big Burn, a fire in 1910, Teddy Roosevelt and the fire that saved America.
If you missed any of that interview with Timothy Egan or anything else on the show, you can get it on demand. Subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter. Get highlights from our guests. You find out what's coming up on next day's show and lots more. Sign up at thetakeaway.org.
And there's so much to think about there. I mean, a fire in 1910. Right. Creates the conservation movement, creates this split in the Republican Party that we are living today.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't escape history.
Rush Limbaugh is on fire. That's the takeaway from this program. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.